Thanks, Quan, for the introduction. So hello, everyone. It's really great to be here. Today, I'm going to talk about a topic that has made me very excited in the past 2 years. So this concerns a special class of galaxy called the Seyfert galaxy. So as we know, Seyfert galaxies and quasars are the two largest groups of active galaxies. So quasars have very bright cores. So their active core outshines the whole galaxy by many times. So they look like a quasi-stellar objects. So Seyferts, similar to quasars, they also have an active core. But that core is less luminous compared to quasars. So we can still see the host galaxy themselves. For example, if we look in optical band, these are some examples of Seyfert galaxies. They look like normal spiral galaxies. But if we look in other wavelengths, actually the core is very active. So this picture shows where this kind of system lies in the unification picture of active galactic nuclei. So as we all know, an active galactic nuclei is powered by a supermassive black hole at the center that is actively accreting matter through an accretion disk. So usually there is this black hole here, and there is an accretion disk supplying matter. Surrounding the accretion disk, there may be a dusty torus that can obscure some of the light from the center. Depending on the viewing angle, we might see different kinds of active galaxies. For example, if there are jets and we are looking down the jets, then we see the blazars. These are the radio loud quasars. The kind of Seyferts I'm talking about actually are radio quiet, so they do not have powerful jets. And I'm particularly talking about these kind of blazars where our viewing angle is relatively close to the axis, so we see directly the center of the active galaxy. They are not obscured by this torus. So that is the class of objects I'm going to talk about. So for these objects...
Sorry, what are the black holes
in the picture?
Yes.
So these things?
I was confused because the radio quiet one looks like it's looking straight at the black hole.
Oh, no, this is just a random pointing. Basically, if there is no jets, then it's a radio quiet object.
Okay. Yeah. So the Seyfert counts as radio quiet?
Usually they are radio quiet. So most of the Seyferts we observe do not have any bright, do not have very strong radio emission. So they usually do not have powerful jets. So that's basically from observations. Okay, so just a brief outline of my talk. So I will first mention the particularly puzzle about these Seyferts, and then I'm going to talk about some possible scenarios for this X-ray emission, and then I will summarize and discuss next steps and future perspectives. Okay, now if we zoom into the central region of these Seyfert galaxies, so the basic picture is like this. So we have a supermassive black hole, and there is an accretion disk. So the brightness of these Seyfert galaxies is usually in this range of like 0.1 to 1 Eddington luminosity. So this is an intermediate accretion rate range. So in this range, the accretion disk is usually believed to a relatively thin standard kind of SUNY-F standard disk. So the accretion disk will be emitting thermal optical UV emissions. And besides this thermal emission from the disk, these objects also have very strong X-ray emission in the hard X-ray band. So usually this X-ray emission is believed to come from a hot corona consisting of hot electrons that are above and below the accretion disk. So these hot electrons will scatter the soft photons from the disk into the X-ray range. So we see the hard X-ray emission from this region. For a long time, what process heats up this plasma here is kind of unknown. And we do not have a good understanding of what is providing the energy source and how the particles are heated and accelerated. So.
Sorry, is this answering some or not some?
Okay, let me just show a bit of the spectrum here. So this X-ray usually composed of the direct emission from the corona usually is a power law kind of shape. That is the continuum X-ray emission from directly from this corona. And when it irradiates the disk, there will be reprocessed X-rays from the disk as well. So this will be this additional component that shows these reflection features, especially these fluorescent ion lines and this quantum hump. So these are the reprocessed X-rays from the disk. This usually, this is like 6 point something keV, and these are softer X-rays by reflecting these hard X-rays from the disk.
So why the reprocessed X-rays are even higher?
So the hard X-ray directly from the source would be a continuum of power law, something like this. This is only the reflection component.
Right, the bump
is like reprocessed by the disk. So the original component is more like a power law, something like that. It's a bright power law. Yeah, this is just the reflected component.
So what's the difference between the dashed and solid line?
Yeah. So here, the dashed lines are the component if you do not take into account the relativistic blurring of the disk. If you include relativistic motion that broadens the lines and also the redshift, gravitational redshift, if the emission comes close to the black hole, then you will see these broadened lines like this.
So what is the emission from the disk itself? The disk itself may also emit some X-rays.
So usually the disk emits thermal radiation
yes.
in the optical X-ray range in this band. This is optical UV. And then this is the total X-ray component, including the direct power law and also the reflected component. So here is basically a broadband spectrum of this kind of system. So in recent years, X-ray observation has made a lot of progress in trying to constrain the geometry of this corona itself. One important technique is called the reverberation mapping. So basically, we see direct emission from the corona itself and also the reflected component from the disk. So these two has time difference because the additional path length for the reflected component. So because the corona emission itself is quite variable, so we can use this time difference to determine how far away the corona is from the disk. So they have used this kind of technique and measured a few systems and find that this distance here is usually just a few gravitational radii in size. It's not much larger than 20 gravitational radii. And this size kind of correlates with the black hole mass. So this indicates that the corona itself is quite compact and located at this special location here. Another piece of evidence is just trying to model the emission lines from the disk to see basically, for the corona emission, and you model each radius reflecting component and see how strong is each reflection component from each radius. From that, you can also constrain the geometry of the corona. And they find that if there may be some flares happening in this region, and in the flare, you might see a corona that is more collimated and maybe slightly outflowing. And then in a low state, it collapsed to a very compact configuration like this here. One more piece of evidence comes from microlensing. Basically, because we cannot directly resolve this source in X-ray band, so if you get lucky and see a source just behind some microlens systems, you might see a very strong variability in the emission, very strong peak there. For example, one image might be microlensed by a star in the foreground galaxy, and you see this rise in the radiation. This kind of macro lensing is sensitive on this size of the emitting source. So the smaller the source you see, stronger the micro lensing signal. So using this micro lensing, people have also deduced that the size of the X-ray emitting corona is small, basically just a few gravitational radii in size, like here.
So why would there be a source up there? I mean, in your picture, there is no, at that point, there is no centrifugal rotation support. So why would they have that source there? What, I mean, you're assuming there is a very thin disk, there's nothing else.
Right.
All of a sudden, there's this thing over there.
And so right.
How do you think you need it to be there or not even? How did it get there in the first place?
Right. So that's kind of the question I want to answer. So in the observations, people usually use very simple models. For example, just put a light source there to model their radiation. But the details about what forms that kind of source is the kind of question I'm trying to study here. Yeah. So indeed, so the questions I'm trying to answer exactly include this, why the corona is so compact and located at such a special location. And also the X-ray luminosity is so high. Sometimes it can be comparable to the thermal emission from the disk. So its X-ray efficiency is quite high. And also, the question actually may be quite relevant to the radio loud and the radio quiet dichotomy. Like some agents are radio loud, they can produce jets. But some, like the cephers, they are radio quiet, they do not have any powerful jets. So
you mentioned before that the origin of the X-ray emission is thought to be Compton upscattering of the disk emission.
Right. So the disk emission can come up, and then the spot electrons there can upscatter these soft photons into X-ray range.
So how is it then possible to have the X-ray emission comparable to the disk emission if this corona is very compact and also located near the black hole?
Right, so that depends on what kind of energy source is put into this corona region. So electrons definitely will cool very quickly through this inverse Compton process. So you need a continuous heating there to...
The fraction of the disk emission that's hitting this corona region is small if it's very compact, right?
Good point, yeah.
Oh, is that right?
She's
talking about like
right. So even for the disk, it's mostly like the inner part is emitting more than the outer part.
Okay.
So because the inner part temperature is higher, I think that is an important factor too.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to start describing our model based starting from this third question, the radio loud and radio quiet dichotomy. So if we ask what is the important ingredients to forming a jet, then we get some answers from GRMHD simulations. Basically, in order to form a powerful jet, we need at least three ingredients. One is the rapid spinning black hole. So we need the black hole to be spinning rapidly to form a powerful jet. Secondly, there needs to be large-scale ordered field threading the inner accretion disk and the black hole. And thirdly, usually there needs to be a good collimation that can collimate the outflow to form a jet. So if we look at the cephers, let's see what conditions are not met so that we do not form a jet. Firstly, let's look at the black hole spin. So there are a few objects people try to measure the black hole spin and find that the value is usually can be as large as close to maximal. So maybe the black hole spin itself is not the main ingredients to form a jet. And then if we look at the collimation, so usually in these GRMHD simulations, there is a thick accretion disk that collimates the jet outflow. So in cephers, we only have a thin disk. Of course, we do not have this kind of collimation. But there is still the possibility that the disk may be producing a wind, which can still collimate the inner outflow. So maybe it's not also because of this collimation effect. So let's look at the third effect, the magnetic field. So if the field is large scale order like this, then it might still be possible to produce some jet-like outflow. So I'm thinking that if the field now is not this kind of let's look at one of the first possibilities is that if the field is indeed like this kind of large-scale ordered field, then is there any plasma kinetic process that make the jet fail there so that we do not form a powerful jet, but instead have most of the dissipation near the black hole?
Sorry, on the collimation through winds, is there an estimate of what the temperature of the disk is to support it? Because if the disk is sufficiently cool,
so the disk, typically in this system, are relatively cooled thin disks. So it's not that kind of hot accretion disk. But yeah, if you need to produce some outflow, maybe you need to use like magnetic effect or some other effect to drive outflows in these systems, I think.
So you go back to putting the plane or in the source on the magnetic field. So
right. It has to
be the right strength, the right topology.
Right. Yes, that's right. So I'm going to talk about two possibilities. The first possibility, I'm still look at this large scale order field and see if there's any kinetic process in this funnel region that makes the jet fail and produce a lot of dissipation. So this starts with the question of what kind of plasma process might be happening in this jet funnel. So as we know, in order to form this outflow through Blanford-Snyak process, there needs to be a current flowing out along this region and some return current flowing back. So this region needs to have enough plasma to conduct this current. But in fact, in these GRMHD simulations, usually the plasma flow is either going into the black hole when it's relatively close to the black hole, or going out along the jet like this at large distances. So this funnel is actually continuously evacuated if a jet is actually formed. So there needs to be a plasma supply into this jet funnel. As we know, the disk matter usually does not get into this funnel because of the centrifugal barrier. And also, they usually do not easily cross magnetic field lines into this central region. So there needs to be some mechanism to replenish the plasma there. And I'm going to see if this kind of process actually dissipates a lot of energy when it produces the plasma there. So the basic idea is like this. So we know that the black hole, if it is rapidly spinning and threaded by a strong magnetic field, then it basically acts like a unipolar inductor in some sense. So it will induce a strong potential drop between the polar region and the equatorial region like this. So if you do not have any plasma out there, there will be a strong electric field. As long as you put in some plasma, it will be accelerated by this electric field, and then these accelerated particles can collide on the soft photons from the disk and produce inverse Compton photons. These inverse Compton photons can then collide with the soft photons to produce pairs. So this launches an avalanche process. So you can use a small amount of plasma there. Just through this process, you can generate a lot of plasma that will fill this region by plasma. So in this case, if the plasma is like flowing out and in and evacuating this region, so we might rely on this kind of process to replenish the plasma there. The question is, where does this pair production happen? And how much energy can be dissipated in this pair production process? So this work has previously been considered using some kind of analytical method by these people, also including like Avery here. But we are going to look at the microphysics self-consistently using a kinetic simulation to look at how the pair production process happens and how much energy can be dissipated. This is the work I have been doing with one here, and a collaborator at Princeton. So our basic setup is actually just taking out one field line from this kind of force-free-like simulation solution of the black hole magnetosphere. So as we know, this is just a split monopole solution in the force-free regime. So if this region is filled by plasma, it's basically this kind of configuration with pointing flux going out along the field lines. So there will be an outer light surface here and an inner light surface here near the event horizon. And this is the so-called stagnation surface. So if you have some plasma that is confined to the field line, then they tend to be flung outward out through this outer light surface, or flung inward to the black hole through this inner light surface. And in this in this region here, it might start to produce pairs as the plasma density gets low. So we just basically set up a 1D model along the field line. And then in our kinetic models, we include this outflow effect near the boundary of our box. So plasma will be evacuated from both ends. And then we see in the inner region, how do we produce pairs? So here, we'll, I'm going to just show a movie of this pair production process. So basically, here is our background current. So we need the plasma to be able to conduct this current. And this is the so-called minimum charge density that is needed to sustain the current and the magnetosphere. So if the plasma density gets low, this current can no longer be conducted, then it would, as you know, the DJDT will generate electric field. And the electric field will accelerate particles and then start this avalanche process to produce pairs. So in this panel, this shows the, So this shows the plasma density, basically. This is the electric field. Initially, we have filled the box with plasma, so there's no electric field. These are positrons, these are electrons. So here, when the density runs low in this region, then it starts to produce pairs. So the black dots are the photons the particles emit. So when you produce enough photons and enough pairs, it screens the electric field, and then the electric field becomes small again. So basically, it's this kind of process. When it's screened, the electric field is small and particle just flow quietly. But when the density gets low again, it starts this to develop this electric field and then accelerate the particles and produce all these photons and pairs. And then if you have enough plasma there, then it can screen the electric field and make the field towards zero again. So it's basically this kind of highly dynamic, quasi-periodic opening up of the gap and then generate particles, and then the gap is screened, and the particles just flow out quietly. Yeah. So this is basically the spectrum. So when the gap is produced, there is a new component accelerated here, the particles. These are the photons that are emitted and absorbed to produce the pairs. So we can see this highly dynamic cycle of pair production.
So the pair production is through Schrödinger process, or what is this process?
No, it's cascade. Can you say that?
Okay. What produces the pairs?
So basically, we have soft photons from the disk. So there's a bunch of soft photons in this region. And then if we have a particle electron that is accelerated by the electric field to high enough energy above the threshold, then it can first collide with the soft photons to produce a high energy gamma ray photon. And this gamma ray photon then collide with the soft photon through gamma-gamma process and produce a pair. And these pairs can continue to be accelerated and produce more pairs, so it gets avalanche process. So that basically produce all these pairs and screens this region. So if the region is screened, then you no longer have this strong electric field, then particles no longer get accelerated and they just flow out slowly, quietly. Yep.
So do you reach a steady state, or what happens?
So this would be a like a microscopic region between the two light surfaces where you occasionally, when the density becomes low, you occasionally open up gap and replenish plasma. If plasma is enough, then basically the whole magnetosphere still behaves like a force-free regime. It's yeah, for this gap, it's basically just quasi-periodic. It's always time-dependent. But the outer region, when it's filled with plasma, it can be quasi-steady. Yeah, it's basically kind of this picture we are imagining. So the pair production process basically depends on if we want to see how much energy is dissipated. It basically depends on how easy or how hard you can produce pairs. For example, if the soft photons are too few, then the mean free path for pair production is too long. Then you need particles to go through a large distance in order to produce pairs. Then in that case, it's hard to screen the gap, and the electric field can grow to very large value, and you dissipate a lot of energy there. But if you have too many soft photons from the disk, then the mean free path for pair production is small, and you just need small amount of acceleration, and then you can produce a lot of pairs. So in that case, if it's too easy to screen the gap through pair production, then you do not dissipate a lot of energy in the gap. So we have a semi-analytical scaling relation for this. Basically, this is the mean free path for pair production. It actually is the inverse of mean free path, the optical depth. And this is the primary energy of the pair producing particles. So you can see that when optical depth is large, or the mean free path is small, then the primary particle energy actually only can be relatively small to produce enough pairs to screen the gap. So in this case, actually the energy dissipated in the gap is small. So actually this kind of process can be happening in especially low luminosity agents like, for example, M87 and Sagittarius A star. They both have very relatively low soft photon field from the disk. And this could be happening to replenish the plasma in the jet funnel. So we find that for M87, actually, the luminosity there is large enough so that the energy dissipated in the gap is actually relatively small. So it's only about 10 to minus 5 of the total jet power. So in that case, actually, we do not dissipate a lot of energy in the gap. But for Sagittarius A star, because it's so underluminous, the soft photon field there is so weak, and then pair producing is actually very hard, it could dissipate a considerable amount of power. And maybe that's some reason why we do not see a jet from the galactic center. So now how about applying this idea to our Seyfert galaxies and see if we can dissipate a lot of energy there. In this case. So Seyferts are relatively bright. They have a lot of soft photons from the accretion disk. So when I try to go through these numbers, I find that with all these soft photons, although you do produce a lot of drag on the particles when they move in the soft photon field, but actually you do not dissipate a lot of power. The maximum amount of power you could dissipate is probably only 10 to the minus 4 if you actually produce a jet-like outflow there. It's because you have too many soft photons there and it's too easy to produce pairs. So the gap does not need to dissipate a lot of energy. You only need to accelerate the electrons to like gamma 10 to the 4, then you can already produce enough pairs and the gap does not dissipate much energy. So this kind of process in these bright Seyfert galaxies won't be able to fill this outflow. It can basically just form an outflow if you have the enough field and the right topology to form the outflow. So we think that this kind of gap probably won't be any significant effect in these Seyfert galaxies. So now, move on, let's see what other process might be possible to dissipate relatively close to the black hole to heat up the corona. So this now let's consider that the magnetic field topology is no longer that kind of large-scale ordered field, but actually more like small-scale loops on the disk. For example, we might think of the solar corona where we have these magnetic flux loops. This may happen on the accretion disk too. So accretion disk, of course, is more violent than the surface of the sun. So there might be very interesting dynamics of the plasma. If we just think about the possibility of like small-scale loops on the disk, for example, there could be a strong differential rotation. For example, the inner part is rotating faster than the outer part. So if we have this kind of flux tube, and after some rotation, we will see that the flux tubes becomes twisted up, especially near the center axis. So you will see a lot of twisting of the field lines near the center. And I'm hoping that this kind of twist here may be able to dissipate a lot of magnetic energy in this region. So in order to study the dynamics of the flux tubes, I have set up some relatively simple toy models. Basically here, I will consider the region outside the disk to be relatively force-free because the density is low and the magnetic energy may be dominating over matter energy. So I think force-free can be a good approximation in the corona region. So basically, we neglect the thermal pressure and inertia of the matter itself. Just look at the dynamics by balancing the Lorentz force itself. OK, let me show you this simple toy model setup I have been looking at. So here, imagine there is a central object here that will be rotating and twisting up the field. This black line represents the accretion disk outside. So the accretion disk is basically, here I just set it to be non-rotating, and it's perfectly conducting that. And the field lines are attached to the accretion disk. So you can see that in this region, I set up some loops here. So the field line have this small loop inside and some bigger loop outside. And then this is a cross-section slice. And this is the 3D picture of the field lines themselves. So as I turn on the rotation of this central object, I will see that the object will twist up the field. And then it builds up a it tries to form a jet-like outflow by twisting up the field. But this twist quickly becomes kink unstable here. Actually, you can see that the field lines are now fully disturbed by the kink instability. Here it's building up, and then it becomes kink unstable and start to becomes some becomes open and some becomes closed back to the disk. And it's continuously twisting and alternating between closed and open as the kink processes on the disk.
But kink, do you need reconnection?
So it will be more clear in this situation. It's like when I first tried to form an outflow, in some cases it could initially open up, but then quickly becomes kink unstable. Especially, let me show you this case as well. So in this case, it kind of becomes open and like forming a jet, but then quickly it becomes kink unstable, and this structure initially it's sloshing around and then becomes basically destroyed.
I don't see any kinks, so I thought you meant to kink this when it reconnects, but kink is that.
Right. It's just like. It's like initially there's this here. So initially there's this jet-like outflow. It's kind of ordered axisymmetric. And then here it starts to wobble around. And you can see this inner region. As it wobbles around, then it gets destroyed. It becomes connected back to the disk instead of forming an outflow.
But there might be reconnection taking.
Yeah, there is definitely reconnection happening.
That's why it's called the kink process.
Right, right. Yeah, actually, yeah, it's a kind of a bad terminology because I'm thinking about this kind of jet-like outflow and then it starts to slosh around and becomes twisted and then get destroyed. Yeah, reconnects to the disk. So these field lines here are continuously reconnecting, alternating between this closed and open configuration there.
What did you vary between this movie and the previous one?
So the difference is that I changed the strength of the field outside compared to the inside. So if the outside in the previous one is very strong, so the inside does not even form an outflow. It quickly kinks as it just started to twist up. This one actually, if the outer field is actually a little bit weaker, this initially open up, but it still kinks. Now, if I further reduce the pressure of the outside field, actually it can form a more or less steady outflow. And this opening angle is large. This is the angular velocity of the field lines. Basically, it's the same as the rotating object.
Sorry, what pressure? Then you're doing force free.
Yeah, it's force free. The so-called pressure is the magnetic pressure I'm talking about. Yeah. So if the magnetic pressure outside is relatively small, the open angle is large, the kink develops more slowly. And you can see this one, it kinks very late. And this one, actually, it no longer kinks because the opening angle is so large that the flow accelerates and gets out of causal contact, and it no longer kinks. It forms a relatively wide angle outflow here.
So this is a Schrodinger problem?
This is just flat space-time. So it's just a central conducting object rotating up the field.
Okay.
Sorry, I should have explained.
So in force-free code, there is a bound equation in the equatorial plane, so you act the field on the
so
rotates with this.
Yeah, exactly. So here in these kind of simulations, the inner object is also perfectly conducting, and it's twisting up the field. Outside, the disk is perfectly conducting but non-rotating, so field lines are anchored on the disk. So here, this is twisting up the field, but the outside is fixing the field.
So you say the one that is stable is the one that has the weakest field or the strongest field?
So this one?
Yeah,
the inner is stronger compared to the outer field.
And what's the physical model behind it? I mean, I thought you're thinking that the fields are provided by the disk.
Right, right.
The disk is the one that produces the field. So they have the choice of saying, oh, it's stronger inside or outside, or vice versa.
Oh, right, right. So let me say a little bit more about it. So I'm using the current in the disk to produce this field here.
Sure.
So I have like different direction of current in the disk. So for example, I have a current going clockwise in the inner region and going counterclockwise in the outer region. So they produce this kind of field loops.
That I understand, but why would nature do that?
Right, that's a good point. So I think in reality, the disk might be producing the field through MRI and dynamo in the disk. So,
but there would be a strong correlation with natural dynamics of the disk.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So here I'm not really taking into account the dynamics of the disk, actually just putting in some field by hand to see how they evolve outside the disk. So a more self-consistent treatment would still also include the dynamics of the disk to see what kind of field is more likely to be produced. Yeah, that's true.
What's the energy origin come from? The distribution of the magnetic field or the rotation?
Yeah, that's right, because the field is twisted up by the rotation of the central star.
Yeah, either magnetic field or rotation energy, which one?
It needs to be the rotational energy, because, if I do not have rotation, the field just sits there, but when I turn on the rotation, it twists up the field, and then that gets dissipated. So it's the rotational energy.
So I guess one question around where does reconnection happen, and is that something that's actually included in this setup? Because I mean, you're not including thermal energy of the plasma.
Yeah, that's a good point. So in the force free, we have to enforce this force free condition so that the Lorentz force is always balanced out. But in reality, during the evolution of the system, you might get regions where you form a current sheet and then force-free condition can no longer be satisfied. There we have to include some numerical dissipation.
Like you want, because that's how you can heat up the plasma.
Right, right. We are hoping to have this dissipation process actually happening to heat up the plasma. But in the force-free code, it does not consider this dissipation process self-consistently. So it's basically just numerical dissipation right now. In the future, we will look at the microphysics there as well.
I mean, this it seems this gap, it shows very interesting oscillations. Do you understand this oscillation? Like I'm looking at the left, upper left.
This one, right?
No, the other one, the upper left diagram. So it shows this interesting,
Like this kink.
Oscillation, right?
Yeah.
Not decay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's that kink mode, yeah.
Oh, it's a kink mode.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's similar to the previous movie I showed with this kink mode. It's just here, my box is too small to show the actual full evolution. Yeah. And so in these examples, I used a perfectly conducting object at the center. But in fact, if we look at the black hole, there's one more interesting parameter regime where, for example, because black hole actually is more like a resistive object, the field lines can slip on the black hole. It's not like a perfectly conducting star where field lines are fixed to it. So you could have a regime where you just have these closed field lines and they just remain steady there. Just this will just be a steady state. This is obtained using relaxation force-free code I have. So it's a fully self-consistent force-free solution in GR, in Kerr metric. So it shows that in this kind of configuration, the field lines can be connected to the black hole and it just remains steady without this kind of building up and twisting and other dynamics. But this relaxation code does not tell me how the field evolves. So I still hope to use the time-dependent evolution to see what might happen to a real black hole. So the kluge I'm using here is that instead of treating the central object as a perfectly conducting object, I include the resistivity on that object to mimic a black hole. So I'm still using a flat space-time force-free code, but I have putting resistivity on the central object so that it behaves more like a black hole. So just to show you something comparison between a true black hole solution and this kind of a kluge, I have resistivity membrane here. So the qualitative behavior is kind of similar. So I think I can try to use this kind of approximation to basically just mimic the electrodynamics property of the black hole. So in the following simulations I'm going to show you, I have this central membrane that is actually resistive and it tries to twist up the field similar to a black hole. So in this case, as I showed you before, when the confinement from the outer field is strong, actually it has this regime of field lines getting twisted, but they do not break out. Actually, they just remain steady there because the black hole is resistive and field lines can basically just slip across the black hole and the black hole rotates, but the field lines do not rotate. They are just fixed to the disk here. So this is the regime when the field here is well confined by the outer magnetic field. So in another limit, when the outer field is actually weak, this inner region can be strong and just break out from a wide angle outflow. Like in this case, you actually see the field here actually break out. This is the angular velocity of the field line. Here it's roughly half of the rotational velocity of this membrane. So in this case, it actually can break out. Basically, if you compare the pressure of the inner field with the outer field, if this is strong, then it can still break out, like in this case. So in the intermediate regime, you try to twist up the field, but the pressure is not enough to break out. Then you see this interesting phenomenon, this kink again. So as this movie, I'm going to show you here, this is the slice. Here is the 3D field, and the current is shown by these surfaces. So you can see that it tries to build up the twist, but then it starts to kink. And you see the kind of same sloshing around of the field lines again. And there is continuous dissipation, because this is a current sheet, as you can see from these isosurfaces. So the current sheet lies between this closed region and this open region. As it rotates, there's continuous reconnection happening across this current sheet that dissipates a lot of energy here. So I tried to look at the pointing flux that is extracted from the rotating object and the pointing flux that goes out to large distances. I find that when this kind of kink happens, most of the extracted pointing flux are dissipated in this region instead of going to large distances. So this can be a variable process of dissipating this extracted rotational energy relatively nearby in this region, close to black hole.
Your dissipation is all numerical now, or is it?
Right. Right now, it's all numerical. I have to admit that it's a little bit an expedient way of trying to still follow the dynamics. But in the next steps, we are thinking of including more physical descriptions of dissipation.
Because you do have dissipation in the conductor in the middle, right? Because you said that white thing is a conductor resistant.
So, yeah, it's a resistive membrane.
So that would be, what would be the ratio of dissipation in the resistor, in the membrane to outside the membrane?
That's a good point. It's like, so the membrane basically behaves like, it basically like a battery with some inner resistivity. So it dissipates half of the energy by itself and then half goes out. Yeah.
Okay, and then the half that goes out, is it at least dissipated outside this piece?
Right, yeah. In this case, it does not go to large distances, but most of them are dissipated in this magnetosphere nearby.
So how fine tuned is this transitional region? Is it just one particular number or absolutely?
Yeah, there exists some range of the pressure difference there.
10% or
correction? Yeah, I think it could be. I'm still doing some parameter studies to actually figure out the more detailed fraction. So there is a significant fraction there that can have this kind of kink mode. Yeah. Okay. So this is just some hand-waving way of saying how about the energetics. Basically, if we get some kind of characteristic magnetic field threading this black hole, now the power extraction actually is quite similar to Blanford's Nayak estimation. Basically, you just estimate the voltage as omega times the magnetic flux, and the power is basically just this V squared over the impedance of the vacuum. And then we find that in order to dissipate most of the energy to provide the observable X-ray flux, as we see from some of the objects, we find that the magnetic field needs to be relatively strong. It's more or less should be close to this value of like the maximum Eddington boundary there. So we still need very strong magnetic field. And in that case, most of the dissipated energy can be most of the extracted energy can be dissipated through this reconnection process in this region. And I'm thinking that this could be an interesting way of like powering this X-ray emitting corona.
Sorry, this argument, that you follow this argument, it would also apply to an AGM, right? Because it's all the physics of the accretion disk.
Right.
And so if I were to estimate use that value of the magnetic field in the different contexts, wouldn't the luminosity of AGMs or laser be very, very large, in which case I have to fight something in some other corner to just not make it overly luminous? You see what I'm saying? So I'm just want to use your argument here. You derive some strength of magnetic field, but to explain your corona behavior.
Right.
But that's linked to the behavior of the disk.
Right.
And I want to draw from that argument and then apply it to
other agents.
I do have a laser. Now
right.
I have a very, very strong magnetic field. And either I'm underappreciating or overappreciating some other terms in the arguments to explain the luminosity of places. Because now my magnetic field is very strong.
So
you either have to tell me, no, I cannot do that.
So yeah, it kind of depends on how strong of the magnetic field is, like in the central region near
sure,
the
that
yeah.
Sense, but that is just depending on the disk, right?
Right, right.
The disk is similarly behaving in both cases.
Right, right. In those quasars, usually there may be like thick disks, and also you might just use the ramp pressure of the accreted matter to concentrate a lot of magnetic field in the center. Here we have relatively thin disks, and the field might be produced by MRI and other dynamo processes in the disk and so on. So the field geometry and strength might be different in the two cases as you consider how the field evolves. For example, in the other blazar or AGN quasar case, you could have the field bringing a lot of brought in by a large amount by the matter that is being accreted into a like magnetically arrested regime or something like that. Then you could have very high efficiency of extracting the black hole power there. Here it kind of also depends on the field topology and what source produces the field. That's a good question. So here, actually, I think eventually we need to look at how the field evolves in the disk to see how this kind of system actually does that agree with the observations.
So you're showing us this different behavior you get depending on the sort of relative magnitudes of the magnetic field in the inner region and the outer region.
Right.
So do you have some way of quantifying that relative strength and which and sort of what values of that you get this lamppost thing, which ones do you not?
That's a good question. So I'm thinking of trying to use the pressure comparison between the inner and the outer field. So the twist should increase the pressure of the inner part as well. So I'm trying to get a better measurement of that quantity. But right now it's kind of still ongoing, and I'm still trying to get a good measurement of that from the simulations.
So in the confined case, do you still have this
In the confined case, actually, it's not dissipating much. If it's confined and not actually having any sloshing, then it's not dissipating much.
But the conductor is existing. It's rotating and existing.
Right. There's only this dissipation at the membrane, but no dissipation in the magnetosphere.
There's no
outgoing
flux from
the... Right. Here, my disk is kind of not rotating, so there's no pointing flux going out to the disk, actually. It's basically most of the dissipation happens in the case when you do have this twist and the kink and the sloshing of the field. So that produces continuous reconnection and dissipation. Okay. So let me just quickly summarize. So I mentioned that from observations, it seems that this kind of compact lamppost type-like corona is quite typical in the Seyfert galaxies. And I think one a possible mechanism to heat up this corona region is the kind of small-scale field from the accretion disk that gets tangled up and dissipates the extracted rotational energy on the axis just above the black hole. So this work is still ongoing, and I discussed some of the toy models using phosphor simulations I'm doing right now. And next step would be to maybe test this using more self-consistent relativistic phosphory or MHD simulations. And also I'm thinking of trying to understand the microphysics of the dissipation and particle acceleration using kinetic simulations. One way is to look at the local region of the current sheet to see how the dissipation happens. Because in this regime of the Seyfert galaxies, there's a lot of soft photons from the disk. Any dissipation process there at the current sheet would also need to take into account the soft photons and the inverse Compton process, or maybe pair production process on the soft photons. So it's a very interesting regime that is not much explored so far. So that's an interesting regime to study the microphysics of the dissipation and particle acceleration. I think that's all I have right now. I'm happy to take more questions and also happy to discuss with you if you have more ideas than comments.
So you've been talking about Seyfert galaxies, and I missed the first 5 minutes of your talk. So are you talking about quasars, or are you distinguishing those two? And why is it intersecting with quasars?
So here, these Seyferts are less luminous compared to quasars. So quasars are usually, people think they have higher accretion rate. And their luminosity is quite high, so they might have a...
But you're talking about like a percent of Eddington to Eddington level.
Right, right.
So it's the same as quasars.
So these Seyferts, in this luminosity regime, people think that they usually have thin disks. But in other, like, more luminous quasars, they might have a thick disk due to...
Like super Eddington?
Maybe
okay.
Super Eddington. So they have a thick disk puffed up by radiation pressure and so on. So in that regime, the disk behavior would be different.
So, I mean, but still, since you are, I guess, within a percent of, more than a percent of Eddington, I guess I'm saying you are still have thermal instability. So you see the radiation pressure dominant, aren't you? Are you a radiation pressure dominant?
Not yet, this guy is.
Yeah, but you think it's not radiation pressure?
Right. Yeah, I think it's not yet. It's yeah, less than that regime.
Okay.
Have you thought about any, this may be too far in the future, but have you thought about any predictions you could make from this scenario for the explanation of the corona? For example, you know, there's a certain total dissipation
right.
of the corona, and how would that scale with the mass of the black hole?
Right.
So in order to compare with observations, are there any scaling relations which might...
Right, yeah, I think... Yeah, those are some of the next steps I'm thinking of doing, like trying to make comparisons to the with the observations. Particularly here, I'm trying to do the total luminosity. But then there are more detailed information, especially like the variability and also the... maybe later the spectrum and the reverberation signatures and so on.
So
and
there,
also,
are there
yeah.
any data in the observations which look intriguing? I mean, are there any unexplained scaling relations in the data so far?
So there are like, for example, recently there are also observations of like stellar mass black hole systems showing similar features of reverberation mapping. And they see that the corona may be changing in size, and the dissipation may get lower when corona is very like small. But when corona is high it might be dissipating more energy. So I think I'm also trying to see if this kind of behavior here can like explain some of these features showing the observation. Yeah, that could have, right, that could happen in those smaller accreting systems as well.
So how constrained are these observations using like X-ray reverberation and so forth on the geometry? Like how far away from the black hole this source should be? Things like that, and how compact it should be? Like sort of like it's tens of n, or are the more precise measurements?
Yeah, so they have pretty precise numbers about this height, like the time difference. So in some cases, they get like very small values, maybe 3 or 5 RG. And in some cases, it could be larger, like 10 or 20. So they do give like very precise values because they basically use very simple models with a point source, like irradiating the disk, and they can fit this spectrum and the time lag to determine what is the actual number. So they do have pretty precise values there. Also, they have the time scaling with the black hole mass. That trend, that's also important information there.
So technically, how do they find the timeline? I mean, these two signals are adding up.
Right. Actually, yeah. So it's I think Yuri. They use a time series technique, basically because the emission is quite variable. So they can use the timing analysis to extract the two components. There may be some mixing. They call this the, they need to take into account if there's some amount of mixing. They call it dilution. It will like introduce some error in the time delay if you mix the two components. But usually they try to extract the part that is most coherent, like you can directly separate the two components.
So we're just looking up, and I think probably the black hole more massive than 6 solar mass, other rates above 5% of electron are radiation pressure dominated. So that would include everything you're going to say. So they do have thermal instability, which I guess could be contributing to what's happening. So this is statement that thermal instability. That means that the cooling and heating doesn't have a stable equilibrium at this local level. If any radiation pressure dominates in this, then you do have thermal instability.
Oh, right. I see.
For optically thick applications, which I guess usually that's what we're talking about. So.
Right.
So I mean that's something. I mean that's kind of that instability could be contributing. Of course, that's instability on the disk, but then whatever that regulator instability, I suppose, could contribute to the heating of the corona. So.
Right. That's a good point because in those stellar mass black hole systems, people usually talk about possible change in the disk, like. But in these Seyferts, it seems like the disk state is kind of steady in most cases.
But I mean, it's the difference. So the stellar mass black holes, I mean, I don't know. There's the different capacity. For those, they would be at low accretion rate. They would be gas pressure dominated. But these guys, they are more radiation pressure dominated than the stellar ones, all the way down to a percent of electron radiation pressure dominated. So,
I see.
So I mean, I guess I'm just thinking that could be why you didn't really do much with the disk. You just do this.
Right. Here, I'm not really considering the dynamics of the disk.
But it could be an interesting thing that this does as well.
Right. Yeah, I should take a look at that.
No, let's thank you.